Well, thank you very much. When I first wrote the title and the abstract for this talk, it sounded like a great idea. And after thinking about it, I started to get nervous. The future of anything is a difficult thing to predict, and I think probably what I'm going to do more than do any prediction is to just kind of talk about the progress of physics in the 20th century, and then make some comments about where complexity fits into that spectrum. I think that in any talk, it's important to understand, where the speaker is coming from, what's their perspective. So I want to give you a little bit of background on my education, my experience. When I was an undergraduate and a beginning graduate student, I was intrigued by the exotic elements of 20th century physics, the notions of relativity, of quantum mechanics, of black holes, of these exotic species of 20th century science. I wound up instead doing condensed matter physics, statistical physics, and low temperature physics, which I found fascinating. I went on as a postdoc at Los Alamos National Laboratory to do, again, low temperature physics, but now looking at kind of hydrodynamic phenomena, what a fluid does at low temperatures. And I moved on to a career looking at nonlinear phenomena in different ways. As Philippe said, the last 12 years I've been the director of the Center for Nonlinear Studies. We had lots of interesting work. It really broadened my view of the world. We had programs in non-equilibrium physics, including how materials bend, how climates evolve, how fluids flow. We had programs in quantum science, quantum information science, condensed matter physics, quantum chemistry, as well as biological sciences, everything from individual macromolecules up to how cells function and how combination of cells function. And finally, information science, which we all know is incredibly powerful nowadays, and which has led to a lot of innovations and new algorithms and new ways to think about all the data that we accumulate in the lab every day. So what I'm really going to talk about is some observations as I was stepping down from being director of CNLS. I was thinking a little bit about perspective and looking back, and I was struck by a number of things that I'd experienced. So this talk is going to be some about my observations about science in general, or physics in general, but also some places where history and my experience have kind of intersected, and to give you some perspective on what might be happening in the next 100 years. So Niels Bohr put it well: prediction is very difficult, especially if it's about the future. And I think that's really good. Here's another nice quote that I like. Physics is a branch of knowledge that is just about complete. The important discoveries, all of them, have been made. It is hardly worth entering physics anymore. This was told to Max Planck in 1878 by a well-known teacher, as you all will learn if you don't already, Max Planck was one of the big innovators in the discovery of quantum mechanics, and his original observations of the quanta that really spurred a lot of the development of quantum mechanics in the 20th century. So he specifically had it very wrong. Something that I've been personally involved in the whole evolution of computing is I'm going to tell you some predictions about computing, but one of the biggest computers in the world at the time, second after the one built at Princeton. This was the second largest. This was the largest computer in the world at the time, 1950s. I was born in 1953. This had an astonishing capability of 30 kiloflops. It used switches on vacuum tubes to create programming. They evolved to using paper tape. You can see the paper tape on the desk there. And what I did, so when I was in high school, before I went to college, my personal computer was a Slide Rule. Many of you have probably never even seen one. It's a very clever device that allows you to make quantitative calculations of things. I'm not that old. And so this is something that existed for most of the 20th century and was quickly thrown away when electronic computers came along. Indeed, this is how we used to program. You would write each line of code on a computer card. Your program would consist of a stack of these cards, hopefully not spilled on the floor and resorted, because otherwise you had a bit of work ahead of you. And you would put these into a machine. It would be read into the computer. The computer would then run your program. You would wait for a long time, and you would get out a long sheet of paper, usually saying, did not compile. So it was a rather tedious and slow process, and the computers were few and far between, so it's not something that you had with you. When I first went to graduate school, it was 1976, my wife saved up 2 weeks' worth of my salary and bought me the first programmable computer on the market, an HP 65. So I went off to graduate school with this powerful hand calculator, which you can now probably buy for a nickel at any good store. And personal computers were not introduced until the 70s, and they started to show up in our scientific laboratory. Now, just to show you how bad prediction is, T.J. Watson was the chairman of IBM in the 1940s. He couldn't imagine anybody having lots of computers. Now, to be fair to him, he was thinking about the large, big computers that were built at the time, and they were rather clubby and hard to move around. This was a prediction of the evolution of the computers 5 years later. Slight reduction in size, in increased speed, not so impressive. Here was a thing about data processing, which I really love. I can assure you that data processing is fat and that won't last out the year. This one, which really took us from the vacuum tube era to the modern computer era, was the invention of the microchip. And that was greeted by engineers at IBM on, well, what's it good for? And finally, there's no reason anyone would want a computer in their home by the president of Digital Equipment Corporation. You can see that between the 70s and today, the evolution of computing has been tremendous. Now, the biggest computers still weigh tons and sit in big, cooled rooms, but in everybody's pocket, is a computer that will do 200 gigaflops. That's how much your new iPhone 6 will do. And if you calculate the ratio of 200 gigaflops to 20 kiloflops, you can see that the increase in computing power has completely revolutionized both modern society and the way science is done. Okay, so when I thought about trying to talk about the future of science, I thought this is a bit presumptuous of me. I should refer to a famous scientist who everybody knows in thinking about some of this stuff. And so, what did Stephen Hawking say? He was talking to the news and to a newspaper when he was in San Jose. And he says, I think the next century will be the century of complexity. And what did he really mean? He meant that we have already discovered the basic laws that govern matter and understand all the normal situations. We don't know how the laws fit together and what happens under extreme conditions. There is no limit to the complexity that we can build using those basic laws. So, interesting kind of perspective. And so let's step back for a minute and see if we can understand how that evolution went forward and what he was talking about. And I think that one of the things I'm going to try to do is give you some perspective on that particular remark. Isaac Asimov was a very good scientist and also a very powerful expositor of the popular notions of physics in the 1950s and 60s. And he said, a number of years ago, I met a certain eminent historian of science. At the time, I could only regard him with tolerant condescension. I was sorry for a man who, it seemed to me, was forced to hover about the edges of science. I was never more wrong. It was I, not he, who was wandering in the periphery. I had fallen victim to the belief that only the very frontier of scientific advance counted, that everything that had been left behind by that advance was faded and dead. So, with that in mind, let me step back a ways, because this was a personally very interesting experience in my life. I remember it very well. And that is that you know, the idea of atoms go back a long ways, back to 465 BC, when Democritus came up with an idea that atoms, that there was this invisible particles that made up of all matter, that they were indestructible, but in particular, they were invisible. Fast forward to the beginning of the 20th century, and J.J. Thomson, the discoverer of the electron, realized that neutral matter without charge needed to be balanced by something else, and he had discovered negative charge. So he proposed that an atom was a plum pudding of positive and negative charges put together. And Ernest Rutherford, in testing this idea, did a scattering experiment where he shot other heavy particles at atoms and saw how they scattered. And what he discovered was that his results were inconsistent with this idea and more in line with a heavy nucleus, a concentrated mass in the center, surrounded by electric charge to produce charge neutrality. That, of course, then prompted Niels Bohr to develop the first elements of a quantum mechanical description of the atom. Now, I remember learning this in high school. I thought this was wonderful. And so, being naive, I would continue to ask my physics professors and teachers, will we ever see an atom? And the answer was uniformly, no. These are invisible things. You will never see an atom. So it was with great pleasure in 1982 at my first professional conference in Los Angeles, the first measurements of atoms on the surface were presented. I thought this was a wonderful thing, and it was a very exciting moment for me, and I think a lot of other people, to see this wonderful invention of the scanning tunneling microscope that revealed the presence of atoms as they sat on the surface. This has gone on to the point where wonderful things can be measured on the surface. I'm just scratching the surface of this. But here is a beautiful example. If you put nickel atoms stadium-like shape on the surface of copper, you can actually see the rippling waves of the electron wave function on the surface. And I just thought this was a wonderful thing. Recently, you've actually been able to look at a gas of atoms, and by being very clever about how you shine light through it, you can actually project the mean shape of an atom and observe it directly. So the notion that you couldn't see atoms turned out to be demonstrably untrue. So a lot of the evolution in physics in the 20th century was about exploring that early discovery and that early realization that atoms existed and that there were pieces of atoms. And so people started looking at constituents. So, you know, if the atom makes up matter, what makes up an atom? And you can imagine, you know, this continuing digging down deeper to understand what is making up the different particles that you observe in this sea of observations. And this just, you know, is not a complete list, and I've left out all the theory that's gone on here, but the neutron discovery in 1932 completed the kind of description of the atomic nucleus surrounded by an electron cloud. This is a picture of the Rutherford experiment. You had a source of particles, it banged into some object, and off scattered different, you know, this is the angle that various particles scattered off of. There were a lot of straight-through ones, but then there were these heavily deflected trajectories, which were representative of what's now called Rutherford scattering and the fact that the nucleus was hard and massive. And so you go through this whole array of particles. I was fascinated as an undergraduate with the neutrino. Discovered in 1956, it's very weakly interacting. It's created in solar processes. It's part of the weak interaction. I thought a neutrino was very cool, and I really wanted to study that. Didn't work out that way. Just as glad, but okay. So then various Murray Gell-Mann and George Zweig came up with this notion that's become the standard model. You haven't learned a lot of this, but they basically discovered how to take all these particles plus a whole other soup of particles and condense them down to eight different particles of different kinds of quarks. And these are mediated by particles. It's a bit past what you've done, but nevertheless, there are these particles that play a role in this jigsaw puzzle, and you know, the increasing this is kind of a laundry list of what people have discovered. I'd like to make a point about particle physics, and I think it's an interesting one. I'll just make it as an observation, and that is that I really like this. This is James Chadwick's Letter to Nature. It's one column, one and a little bit of column. With this paper, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1936. Discovery in 1932. I love the comment by the editor. The editor does not hold himself responsible for opinions expressed by his correspondents. Neither can he undertake to return or correspond with the writers rejected manuscripts intended for this or any other part of it. It's a different process today. Nevertheless, this was the ability to make relatively simple measurements by yourself in the laboratory to reflect a fundamental particle. In 1956, the neutrino was discovered using particles at a nuclear reactor in the United States, the Hanford nuclear Hanford, Washington. There were five authors on this paper, and they used a bubble chamber, which allows you to track these individual particles because of their effect on the hydrogen gas, or a cloud chamber on gas near its condensation point. Here is the LHC discovery of the Higgs boson, 6,000 authors on that paper. Just like to do a exponential plot of the number of authors per discovery for the Nobel Prizes since Chadwick. This expresses the increasing difficulty and complexity of these experiments. This is the neutrino. These are the J and psi particles. In the 1970s, I remember coming to school one day and a graduate student saying they just discovered the psi particle at SLI. He was very excited. You know, the W boson at LHC by Carlo Rubbia and all. Here are the two recent Nobel Prizes. Small shift here with respect to these guys. This is Fermilab top fork, and this is the Higgs boson. The intersection of this line is about when large accelerators were created, and which fueled this kind of exponential growth, both in the number of authors, but also if you plotted the total energy in the accelerator, you'd also get some kind of exponential curve. All right. So what happens when you smack a bunch of these things into a bunch of other things? You create what's called a quark-gluon plasma. This is a very complex many-body state, highly interacting. There's nothing simple about it at all. It's the origins, you know, people talk about it as fundamentally having to do with the origins of the Big Bang and what happens. But, you know, complexity is certainly going to range involved in any understanding of this particular state of matter. Okay, so back up. What's another one of the big modern physics accomplishments of the 20th century? Relativity. So, you know, relativity, special relativity is really simple. It's the observation that Einstein made that the speed of light doesn't depend on your reference frame. And if you do that, then it's easy just geometrically to show that a click of a tick of the clock of a light beam passing between mirrors is just the distance between the mirrors divided by the speed of light. If that clock is moving with respect to you, you see that tick is taking longer. And that relationship, if you believe that C is independent of your reference frame, leads to a wonderful array of paradoxical things. We don't think of time as being absolute, and you have to kind of readjust yourself to this notion that in fact time is not. And so it's a wonderful introduction to non-intuitive kind of physics. Another thing which has fascinated me because the first laboratory experiments were done on this right before I went to graduate school was general relativity. So what is general relativity? General relativity is the warping of the fabric of space-time by mass. It's a very subtle, small effect. Shown to bend light moving around bodies by Eddington in the early part of the 1900s, and made Einstein a famous guy, because nobody thought that bending a light was going to happen, and he predicted exactly how it was going to bend. But an even more fascinating fact is that clocks run slower in strong gravitational fields. And you know, this was something that in the 60s took a tour de force experiment to actually measure. And so how big is this effect? So if you had a satellite out at four times the radius of the Earth, then the clocks would run faster by about 15 microseconds per day. That's pretty darn small. On the other hand, atomic clocks have become, over the last 50 years, stable to 1 second in 60 million years. And so if you could put those in orbit, which they did, this is an atomic clock in space, what do you have? You have the GPS system. The GPS system is the most precise measure of general relativity ever performed, and we have it in our phones. It's really remarkable, and it goes towards one of the beliefs of the 20th century is that exotic ideas that you don't think are going to matter eventually will turn up in important applications. All right. Let me just say a little bit about atomic clocks, because they also have this exponential decrease or increase in stability. This is the uncertainty of frequency uncertainty of world-leading clocks and their evolution in years. The first accurate atomic clock was created in Britain in 1955. Today, this was in about 2000, there's actually a NIST F2, which is somewhere down here, and actually the most accurate clock is close to 10 to the minus 18, that is 1 second in the age of the universe. Bill Phillips, who is a Nobel Prize winner at NIST, likes to say, good enough for government work. This is what something like that looks like. With this device, you can measure the gravitational redshift, in other words, the slowing down or the speeding up of time, by lifting your clock 10 centimeters off of the tables. It's truly a remarkable thing, I just think it's wonderful. Now, on the other hand, this kind of says, if I'm going to make things another 100 times more accurate, I'm going to start running into the fact that the table is going to vibrate a little bit, and it's going to move up and down by a little bit, and that's going to create an inherent uncertainty in the time standard. One can't go on like this forever, but it is awfully fun to see this kind of stuff. Okay, but coming back to this issue about, you know, what's simple, what's complex, what are easy ideas, you know, relativity is really quite a mess. The general relativity equations are nonlinear, they're hard to solve, and they give rise to a lot of complex and rich phenomena that we will continue to explore in astrophysics for a long time. So I think that general relativity is in this kind of realm of a lot of richness. People argue about whether there are black holes, whether there aren't black holes, whether there are wormholes, whether they even exist. These are all relatively simple solutions to the general relativity equations. Okay, let me switch to condensed matter physics. I like condensed matter physics. I was born in the condensed matter physics department. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the history of condensed matter physics. Landau was one of the first people to look at collective phenomena in develop theory. So first I'm going to tell you something about the theory of this. He described a property called superfluidity, which I'll tell you a little bit more about. And there were a number of kind of heroes of this age. Louis Nail did a lot of work on magnetism, identified what's called antiferromagnetism. You haven't probably come across that yet. Phil Anderson, John Van Vleck, in the 1970s, taught us a lot about how electrons create magnetism in materials. And these are very important advances. And then there was the area of semiconductors. Semiconductors are in all our phones. There was the early ideas, Felix Bloch developed ideas about how electrons interact with atoms in a metal. Block waves, free electrons. Wilson, Schottky, and Mott further developed that theory. And in the mid-1940s, this was realized in a real device. Bell Laboratories wanted a faster switching device, a material that they could replace vacuum tubes with, and they developed the transistor in the 1940s. For this, they won the Nobel Prize and revolutionized the modern age. Schottky went to Silicon Valley and started the semiconductor industry there. And today, but before I get on to where we are in semiconductors, let me tell you a little bit about divergence of views of what is fundamental and what isn't in physics. Wolfgang Pauli was was a really important developer of the Pauli exclusion principle, contemplated the neutrino, really smart guy, one of the founders of quantum mechanics. He commented to Rudolf Virchow, one shouldn't work on superconductors, that is a filthy mess. Who knows whether any superconductors exist? He went to Bell Labs in the 50s after they discovered the laser and the transistor, and they showed him around and they wanted to impress him. And he replied characteristically, I guess it's harmless enough. Another famous particle physicist, Murray Gell-Mann, used to talk about solid state physics as squalid state physics. There's an irony here, as pointed out by Steve Simon at Oxford, who famously believed that there was nothing interesting in any endeavor but particle physics. Interestingly, he now studies complexity, a field that mostly arose from condensed matter. This shows the hierarchy of assigning credit. I would say that that's not true. But in any event, I think much more the physics of complexity arose out of those people who were studying statistical physics and hydrodynamics and not necessarily condensed matter physics. But there's this hierarchy of claim. Murray actually works at the Santa Fe Institute, which is an institute near where I work, and which has long claimed to be the world's center of complexity studies. Let's go back to the microprocessor. All of that work on semiconductors, what has it been good for? It's been good for a lot. You know, we've gone, as I said, in the computing regime from the 1970s with 8,000 transistors on a chip to today, you know, 2 billion, 5 billion computers on a chip, and a tremendous advance in speed and complexity of electronics. In terms of impact, this impact has been huge, right? The semiconductor industry by itself, just the creation of semiconductors, is worth over $350 billion a year. And using those to create products, Apple alone is a $750 billion. This is arising from understanding the fundamental principles of condensed matter and solid state physics as developed both empirically through measurement and theory over the course of the 20th century. All right, so this is a potpourri of different physics, and you know, there's a lot I'm not going to talk about. But one of the things that I was fascinated with, because I grew up doing low temperature physics, and so the holy grail of low temperature physics is to get things cold enough so that quantum mechanical coherence, remember H bar is the only thing that matters in physics in the 20th century, and that is that quantum coherence produces a macroscopic quantum phenomenon. So superconductivity is an example of that. You have a material who, when you cool it off to a sufficiently low temperature, its electrical properties may be called superconductive state. So if I have a circuit like this with a battery, I apply a voltage, current passes through a resistance. For a superconductor, R is zero. And when one says zero, it is precisely zero. You can get currents that will flow without energy dissipation for months without any loss. So this was really a remarkable discovery, and it has led to lossless generation in power transmission system, to levitated trains. The only downside is it has to be cold. Back to that. The theory of it took 46 years. This is Bardeen, Cooper, and Schrieffer. They wrote down a quite complicated Hamiltonian, which then reproduced the properties of superconductivity in a tour de force theoretical accomplishment. And this is simple superconductivity. Okay. All right. So another macroscopic quantum phenomena is something that I worked on, which is superfluid. So if you take a liquid in a tube like this, and you raise the pressure by raising the height of the fluid on the inside, and you have a thin gap, then the flow through that gap will tell you something about the viscosity of that fluid. And if you measure then the rate at which this level goes down for a particular pressure drop, you can tell something about the properties of that fluid, the viscosity of that fluid. And what you discover is that as you pass through a particular critical temperature, the viscosity drops by a large fraction. And indeed, if you do a modern experiment, it essentially drops to zero. So this fluid flows without resistance in a similar way to a superconductor. This was discovered in 1938, won Peter Kapitsa the Nobel Prize. A special state that might be called superconductor. Again, it has to be cold to get quantum coherence. You can do lots of fun things with superfluids. You can drive a fountain. How do you do that? If you take the fluid and you put it in a closed container so that when it's not superfluid, no flow can get out. Now you drop below the superfluid transition, so it's a porous plug of material. So it has very high viscous drag. Essentially nothing gets through. But when you drop below the superconducting transition, the superfluid transition, the superfluid component of the stuff can flow freely through, and you create a fountain by heating it. You create a fountain of the superfluid squirting out through the gap. It's very cool. Again, low temperature joke. I'm sorry. You can actually see this. It works like a two fluids. The superfluid flows towards the heated object. And this was visualization done in a laboratory in Maryland in 2011. Again, one of those things I never thought I would see directly, but they figured out a way to see it. And so there are particles you can see going in both directions carried by the normal and the superfluid. And in this particular case, whereas heat normally diffuses, it travels ballistically. Another very cool thing about helium is that the vorticity, or the swirl of things, is quantized. So just as levels in a helium atom or a hydrogen atom are quantized, so is the circulation that can exist in a rotating bit of fluid. And so this was an experiment. It was predicted, this idea of the quantization of vorticity was predicted in 1947, visualized for the first time in 1979, and then made a big deal about in Bose-Einstein and condensate people who had forgotten that it had already been done in helium 30 years before. Sour grapes. Anyway, so other things, macroscopic quantum phenomena, Bose-Einstein condensates. Bose-Einstein condensates are the simplest condensation that you can have, very weakly interacting, it's very fun. Made possible in the 80s, superfluid helium 3, a different kind of superfluidity was discovered in the 70s. I'll just skip over this. You know, these are the two big advances for which Nobel Prizes were won in condensed matter physics. The Hall effect is you pass a current through something in a magnetic field, and you get a voltage which develops because charge is bent by the Lorentz force. And what you find is if you cool it off enough, you can get quantization of this conductance. So these are the steps, and then later on, one showed that you could not only get steps at integers of the quantized variable, you could actually get fractional steps. And these two were very important in understanding cooperative electronic phenomena at very low temperatures. In 1986, one kind of, in condensed matter physics, you kind of ran into a roadblock here. Done some very nice stuff, superfluidity, superconductivity. In 1986, this was a very exciting time in condensed matter physics. The meeting that I happened to go to in 1987, American Physical Society meeting in New York City is called the Woodstock of condensed matter physics. Everyone was there. Everyone was excited. This was good. This was the new frontier of condensed matter physics. Everybody was very excited. What has happened is that in 30 years of continuous work, there is no satisfactory explanation for why these materials superconduct at a high value. I would claim that this is again, we're starting to reach this limit where simple ideas have been panned out, and one is really having to come up against the interesting phenomena are ones that are hard, they're complex, and they take a lot of time to figure out. Another example, I think, of a sign that we're coming to not the end, but a time in physics where fundamental, quote unquote, discoveries as we thought of them in the 20th century are harder and harder to come by. If you look at the Nobel Prizes in the last 15 years, a lot of them have been for the development of technology as opposed to fundamental discovery, whereas the first part of the 20th century up until the end of the 60s, almost every Nobel Prize was either for some fundamental principle that you could articulate. And let me just name a few. You know, blue LEDs was last year's Nobel Prize. A few years before that was the development of semiconductor heterostructures. CCD chips in your camera. You know, your iPhone has a really wonderful camera that's made up of CCD chips. Has changed how people take pictures. You know, I used to use a Polaroid and send off to the people and wait a few weeks and get a picture back and then go, oh, damn, out of focus. Integrated circuits pioneered the idea that you know, of miniaturization, an ability to make really small computers. GMR reed heads are created from giant magneto resistant materials. Fiber optics that transmit a lot of the signals that we get over the internet. Those were deemed worthy of a Nobel Prize. And graphene, although it has significant scientific implications, I think a lot of the reason that it was given an early Nobel Prize was because of the potential for actual practical applications and devices and sensors that could be built. So let me come to this issue of what does it mean to be fundamental, because I think there's sometimes interesting dialogue about that in science in general and in physics. Phil Anderson wrote a paper, a commentary in 1972, it's worth reading the whole thing, but in which he said the ability to reduce everything to simple fundamental laws does not imply the ability to start from those laws and reconstruct the universe. In particular, he said the constructionist hypothesis breaks down when confronted with the twin difficulties of scale and complexity. At each level of complexity, entirely new properties appear. Psychology is not applied biology, nor is biology applied chemistry. We can now see that the whole becomes not merely more, but very different from the sum of its parts. And this was really quite, you know, Phil wrote it as a parry to the high energy physics, but it really is an interesting general kind of commentary on the kinds of physics that one does in nonlinear systems and in complexity. So now I'm going to tell you a little bit about some places where complexity and physics intersect. Things that I like, you know. Again, this is just you know, personal. Pick from a nice box and take out what you want. And I've studied turbulence. Turbulence is a really old problem. Da Vinci figured out that it was an interesting thing to study in the 1500s. He described the characteristics of the river and he decomposed it. He named turbulence, but it would be 400 years later or so before any real progress was made. So what is turbulence? I'm not going to give you a definition, but seeing the kind of dynamic swirling flow that exists both in nature and in the laboratory gives you a sense of the complexities of turbulence. This is humidity in the atmosphere. It's a beautiful picture and it really allows you to see a lot of the changing patterns that evolve the great difficulty in predicting, for example, the weather. Here's some experiments that I've done I like them, so I get to show them. This is my fun. This is again a driven fluid system. It's a soap film, actually. The striations there are just visualize how the soap film is being dragged around. Here's another one where we were able to map out the velocity field. This is how turbulence takes some pollutant or something and disperses it rapidly in the environment, mixes things up. I'm not going to tell you any of the details of this fascinating phenomenon, but I'll make a few commentaries about it. Sir Horace Lamb wrote a very famous book on hydrodynamics. He was also very intrigued by quantum mechanics. In a talk to the Royal Society in the early part of the 1900s, he made this remark: "I'm an old man, and when I die, I go to heaven. There are two problems on which I will seek enlightenment: quantum electrodynamics and turbulence. About the former, I am rather optimistic." If you fast forward 40 years, indeed, he was right on. Feynman, Schwinger, and Tominaga solved the QED problem of quantum electrodynamics and won the Nobel Prize for it in the 60s. And said Richard Feynman had a lot of interesting things to say about turbulence, actually. In the Feynman lectures, which are lectures really aimed at graduate students, but pretended to be given to undergraduates, he said, "Finally, there is a physical problem that is common to many fields, that is very old, and that has been that has not been solved. Nobody in physics has been able to analyze it mathematically satisfactorily, in spite of its importance as the sister sciences, which is the analysis of circulating or turbulent fluids." He went on to say, "The simplest form of the problem is to take a pipe that is very long and push water through it at high speed. No one can analyze it from first principles and the properties of water. This is a central problem which we ought to solve someday, and we have not. And the reason that we have not is because it's inherently a nonlinear complex problem. I think these are the kind of some of the problems that we will come back to in physics in the 21st century." Here's a beautiful movie of how turbulence actually impacts the world. Here is this is motions of the surface taken by NASA, real Earth surface data that shows the motions of the Earth's ocean. And you can see there's a lot of dynamics. There's a lot of changing conditions. There are a lot of swirling, eddying flows, and these are, you can't calculate this from first principles at all. You have a hard enough time even understanding it when you can measure lots of the details associated. Anyway, I thought it was a cool movie. But what are the impacts of this? I think in the 20th century we were understanding how to manipulate our world. We were learning how to control it. We were learning a lot of the fundamental principles of what goes around us. But we're starting, I think it's undeniable now that the human society is creating great changes in our climate. And one of the problems that we're going to have in the 21st century is, how do we mitigate it? How do we understand it? How do we know how big the effect is going to be? How much effort do we want to put in? A lot of that is going to be through the complex interactions of many of the kinds of problems I've talked about, from turbulence to waves to the absorption of light in by clouds. All of these things are complex problems. They're really key to understanding the future, and they're really important to work on, but they're hard. Here's another one. I love this picture. Coronal ejection from the surface of the sun. It produces magnetic storms on the Earth. It can take out power systems. When realized on the Earth, the large fusion reactor is being built in southern France. And the idea is that it will provide an inexhaustible energy source for the future, perfectly green, perfectly wonderful. The joke about this kind of energy source is fusion is our future and always will be. However, this is a really important problem. It's a really complicated one. If you think the fluid, the swirling fluids are hard, now add magnetic fields and plasma conditions where the electrons and the ions dissociate, and now you've got electric fields, you've got magnetic fields, you've got charge distribution, and you've got all this turbulence running around. This is a really hard problem. Again, hard, complex problem, hasn't really been addressed by in the physics community. There's a single Nobel Prize for plasmas, alphane waves, where he won the Nobel Prize. This is hard stuff, but it's important stuff. Earthquakes. I'm just going to talk about earthquakes because I do a little bit about earthquakes and it's cool. So here we go. Earthquakes cause a lot of damage. They're very complex. They're complex objects because we can't really measure much about them. We can't go down into the earth. We can't, you know, see what's going on. The earth slips and we build models and we do numerical simulations and we try to look at the waves that are propagated. So one of the things that I've been working on, here's my laboratory realization of an earthquake. Very simple, but from a physics point of view, maybe it develops intuition. These two plates are being sheared with respect to each other. They're mediated by ground up material, in this case granular material, and the forces are transmitted from one side to the other, and earthquakes occur, which have a lot of similarity to earthquakes in nature. Are they related? Good question. That's a lot of challenge for physicists to connect the laboratory experiments with the experiment with real complex phenomena, because lots of things are going on. Here's what the granite grains do. We can see everything that goes on. Can we understand this simple system? Even this is hard. Here's something that's going on. Here's something that's really nice. It's going on in your department. Sergio Chiliberto, who I've known for many years, I read this paper and I thought, this is really fun. Does information equal heat? It's a fundamental question in statistical physics, and you should go read this article. It's a wonderful article about that particular question. Let me say a little bit about another interesting area of physics, which is soft matter. And Pierre Dejean, again, the only Nobel laureate in this kind of soft matter complexity kind of arena to have won the Nobel Prize for his works on polymers and liquid crystals. Soft matter is you know, the unexpected behavior, cooperative behavior of oddly shaped things. So polymers do a lot of interesting things, including encoding the genetic information in our cells. You can take polymers and make surfactants, so they coat surfaces and create what are called micelles within fluids. Most importantly for all of us is they create membranes. They do this by having a hydrophilic head and a hydrophobic. Hydrophobic means it wants to stay away from water. Hydrophilic means it loves water. Put these things in water and put enough of them in and they'll form a layer which hides the part that doesn't want to be in the water. This then, when combined with understanding of proteins, leads to biological membranes, which are all about how we live in today. How information gets transmitted in and out of cells. It's why we get sick. It's why we function every day. And understanding the complexity of this is one of the challenges of the 21st century. Lots of interesting elements of other kind of cooperative effects, bunches of particles, either granular or colloids, where thermal vibrations matter. Here's a beautiful picture of metallic glasses. Here's my favorite picture of phones. Another challenge for the 21st century, from my perspective, is and it's really hard, is why do we think, what is the elements of how the brain works in a way that can explain why we have independent thoughts and we can think about ourselves, and this is really a fascinating idea about whether this is, there's something intrinsically magic about this, or whether it's just this mechanistic combination of all the neurons in our brain that leads to thinking. Astrophysics is a great place for complexity. The cosmic microwave background that existed as the universe cooled, how that background arrangement of particles led to structure in the universe, the formation of galaxies, how stars formed out of that condensing gas, how then black holes form, and finally, through cataclysmic events somewhere in the universe, can we detect those through the emission of gravity waves? I think these are all fascinating subjects arena. This is long-range interactions. It's really a statistical mechanics problem. You know, there's a lot of interesting physics about how you get rid of angular momentum, how the hydrogen gas condenses, how it starts to burn, how black holes suck things in accretion disks. Amazingly rich bigger problem. Supernovas. Here's a simulation of supernovas. I think this is another multi-physics problem, a lot of complexity going on. I'm getting near the end, so let me just say a few things. I think that you know, we've gone a long ways in the 20th century and by solving equations and by digging deeper in a reductionist kind of way. But as Feynman pointed out, the next great era of awakening of human intellect may well produce a method of understanding the qualitative content of equations. Today we cannot. Today we cannot see that the water flow equations contain such things as barber pole structures of turbulence. Today we cannot see whether Schrodinger's equation contains frogs, musical composers, or morality, or whether it does not. So at the end, why should you do physics if there's all this complexity? So I'll give you my take on that, and then I'll tell you why you should be suspicious of any take that anybody has on anything. I went into physics because I thought concepts were great. You know, you take a little bit of physics, like F equals ma, that energies and angular momentum are conserved, that there are conserved quantities, and off you run through the world, explaining things, and you know, you don't have to. Take into account all those facts, like, you know, you have to do in biology, where I got to figure out what all those stupid, you know, organic chemistry molecules are and how they stick together and what the blood thing looks like. It's like building a car or something like that. You got all these parts and you stick them together. I just couldn't deal with that. So I love physics for that reason. So concepts are great, but learn the concepts, learn how to use them. That's what physics is all about. Spend years on the same concepts, looking at them from different ways, trying to figure out what they mean, because when you master them, then you have a real power of being able to look at the universe and try to understand. Simple models are what physicists like to do. Now, I've showed you some very complicated models, the BCS superconductivity, some of these other things. Simple models provide insight, physical intuition about things. Doesn't always get it right, but it's a really powerful approach in physics, and one which has a lot to be said for it. But another part from simple models is that physics teaches you quantitative analysis. Physicists are not afraid of Fourier transforms and complex variable analysis. And you know, you plunge away, you do your thing. I have a friend of mine, he's a National Academy of Science member, he's a very distinguished biological physicist, and he says, the only mathematics that a biologist knows is the exponential function, and that just barely. So he spent a lot of time trying to convince them of power laws in biology. Physics provides you with that quantitative ability to to make models, to solve them, and to do interesting things. Now, some more controversial thoughts and comments. I really think fundamental is in the eye of the beholder. I've always kind of just been fascinated by things, and when I didn't understand things, that was fundamental for me. You know, I to some degree, this notion that, you know, the only important thing in the world now is understanding string theory and the origins of you know, particle physics. You know, I like a lot of things in condensed matter physics. I think nonlinear physics is really fascinating. Part of my problem, I think it also gives me a maybe a little bit more objective view on the world. I'm just interested in all sorts of things. I really get a kick out of understanding something I don't know, and I've been able in my career to kind of to do a little bit of that. But remember, you know, there's a hierarchy of fundamentals. So the particle physics will tell the condensed matter physicists that what they're doing is not fundamental. And the condensed matter physicists will tell the hydrogen dynamicists what they're doing is not fundamental, because it doesn't include something, you know. It's squalid state physics, or if it's hydrodynamics, it doesn't include H-bar, and that's classical physics, so that's not fundamental. And then the person who's doing kind of the fundamental part of turbulence, you know, will talk to the mechanical engineer, who will say, you know, I mean, so there's this whole hierarchy of, you look up and you look down, and the people who are doing more abstract stuff, you say, or less real stuff, you know, real to the real problem of whatever it is. Everybody says, oh, you're just doing pie in the sky, and if you look down, you're just doing practical stuff and making all of these approximations, and it's not real. And it's just a continuum of nonsense. One of the things I think that you will learn, and that I have come to realize, is that publications have created, there's a publication environment that has created a certain amount of nonsense in science that has to do with, you can't really solve the hard problem, so what you do is you invent an interesting sounding problem, you relate it then to something that everybody will agree is important. You know, you want to study how two particles interact, so you say that you know, curing cancer is important, and so now I'm going to study this problem that really has nothing to do with it. But you know, I think this is you know, something that you know, the only way you can get these published in fancy journals is to claim that you're doing these wonderful stuff. And so, but beware of that. Be honest. Science really is not done by hype artists. It's hard slogging work. This is a tricky one, because I spent my entire career doing basic science. But I think that at the beginning of the 21st century, we have to start asking the question of whether or not basic science by its own is justified. And you know, the argument always is, look at Einstein. He wasn't being paid. He was a patent clerk, and he was you know, he invented stuff that led to GPS, and look at all the wonderful things that flowed from those fundamental discoveries. Same with quantum mechanics. On the other hand, you know, in those days, in the early parts of the 20th century, there might have been 1,000 physicists in the world who really knew what they were doing, and who had access to the information and what was going on. There were a few places in the UK, at Cambridge, in Germany, and in France. And, you know, today there are over 1 million scientists, 1 million physicists who self-identify as physicists. It's a lot. And the question is, what's the right balance between doing something useful that will, for example, help create, you know, a $1 trillion industry like superconductors, and or explain important challenges of plasma energy for the 21st century, you know, through fusion, or you know, what's the right balance? I think as a scientific community, these are important questions, and ones that you should ask whoever you get involved with. I believe the physics challenges of the 21st century will be increasingly complex. But the problem there is that that richness is easy to get lost in. I've studied problems that I could have studied for 30 years, and I would have found an interesting thing to study every day, you know? And I would have found something that nobody knew, and that, but at the end of the day, it was just because there's so much richness out there. It's like burying down on a fractal. You just, more and more detail, more and more detail, and then you have to ask yourself, well, what's the point? Okay, this had a big impact on me because I was an impressionable graduate student, and I had learned about quantum mechanics. I'd taken my first graduate class in quantum mechanics, very excited. And so somebody came, he was a historian, so historian of science, and he came to give a colloquium, and we were all very excited to understand what the origins of the Schrodinger equation were. And so we went, and this guy laid out this very complicated edifice of how Lagrangian and Hamiltonian dynamics and classical physics, you know, led to the relationships with the Schrodinger equation. I was, this is beautiful. This is wonderful about how science fits together. So at the end of this talk, Rudolf Peierls was on sabbatical. Rudolf Peierls was a protege of Pauli and Heisenberg. He knew all of the actors in this play. He knew Schrodinger. He knew Sommerfeld. He knew this whole group of people. It was a small community. So he stands up at the end of this talk, and he says, that's all very nice, but that's not the way it happened at all. And I thought, whoa, what does that say? First of all, it says it's easy for historians to get things wrong if they have a particular point of view. But it also is a lesson about what you learn in your classes. People provide for you a looking back of how things fit together that makes sense, that's the easiest to access. It's important to remember that science is not done that way. Science is done by sausage making, by bits of inspiration or luck or hard work or whatever. And it's important to look back appreciate that as you're going forward into what could be a career in physics, or if you're not, just to appreciate the wonderful edifice that was created in the 20th century and that will be that we look forward to attacking in the 21st. Thanks a lot.